It is Friday, April the 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, more questions about President Trump's former national security chief. Also ahead, Mr. Trump's first 100 days in office.
This is not perhaps the worst 100 days since we began keeping score with FDR, but it's up there. I mean, this is nothing compared to FDR, LBJ, or even Obama or Reagan. This first 100 days, C-minus at best.
Another copy of the U.S. Declaration of Independence has been found. We'll have trends in social media plus the D.C. Film Festival. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. New documents show President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, took more than $500,000 from Turkey and tens of thousands of dollars from Russian interest after being warned in 2014 when he retired as an Army general not to accept payments from foreign governments. Democrat Bonnie Watson is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives Oversight Committee looking into the influence Russia might have had on last year's presidential election and any connection between the Russian government and anyone on the Trump team.
Chairman Chaffetz has said in the past that there is nothing that this Oversight Committee cannot see, that it is nothing that Congress cannot see. There is no excuse other than to enact executive privilege that would stop us from seeing something. And so the White House needs to tell us, is that what you're doing?
White House spokesperson Sean Spicer answered questions about a trip Flynn made to Russia before becoming part of the Trump team.
You know, obviously, there's an issue that as you point out, the Department of Defense Inspector General is looking into. We welcome that. But all of that clearance was made by the Obama during the Obama administration and apparently with knowledge of the trip that he took. So that's how the process works, and I welcome the Department of Defense's IG's review.
U.S. military says it is probing whether the retired lieutenant general failed to obtain required prior approval before accepting money from foreign governments. The Pentagon investigation, launched in early April, appeared focused on the more than $33,000 Flynn earned to attend an RT television gala, that's Russian television, in December of 2015, when he sat at a table with Russian President Vladimir Putin. President Trump's 100th day in office is coming soon. In fact, it'll be April 29th. Many observers and presidents see the first 100 days as an important milestone for measuring legislative and foreign policy achievements, but it has no official significance. International Edition's Lori London asked Jeremy Mayer, who is a professor of the School of Government and International Affairs at George Mason University, why so much attention is paid to these early days of the presidency, often referred to as the honeymoon.
What begins with FDR and what he accomplished in his first 100 days set a standard that no subsequent president has ever matched. But it gives the media a kind of scorecard. The reason that the honeymoon is so important in the eyes of many presidential scholars and media pundits is that typically it's the moment when a president has the most probability of achieving important things. So Reagan achieved other things in his 8 years, but he sure got a lot done in those first 3-4 months. And Obama, in passing his stimulus package in that period and doing some important groundwork on healthcare, got his presidency off to a reasonably good start as well. So when we look at what Trump has done, there's really only one solid accomplishment. And it is an unusual one. It's very rare for a president to get a Supreme Court nomination just waiting for him upon arrival at the White House. I can think of only a couple other examples. This was a very good nomination for Trump. He got him on the court pretty quickly. But after Gorsuch, this covered is almost bare of accomplishment.
The president recently said that no one else has achieved what he has in the first 100 days.
This is a president who is prone for exaggerating and, his critics say, lying. That is simply not true, and I don't know anyone who's serious who would ever make that statement. This is not perhaps the worst 100 days since we began keeping score with FDR, but it's up there. I mean, this is nothing compared to FDR, LBJ, or even Obama or Reagan. This first 100 days, C minus at best. It's too soon to declare, of course, Trump's presidency a failure or a success. But now that we're on day 90, unless something amazing happens in these 10 days, this has not been a great 100 days. We have never in the modern presidency had a president at this point in his reign this low in the polls. We've had presidents get lower than this after they have disastrous wars or Watergate-style scandals, but usually this is what we call the honeymoon. This is when the other side gives you a chance and your own people never love you more, but even Republicans are not tremendously strong behind this man at this point in his presidency. I'm teaching this course on presidential honeymoons, and I had them read an article on image management in the presidency. And then as an exercise, I divided them up into Trump and Democrats and taught, you know, how would you attempt to create a negative or a positive image of Trump moving forward? And one of my students said, you know, there was an article in Politico. This is what the White House communication team was doing just last week. And I went into the article, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, how, with a blank sheet of paper, what do we want to say about Trump? And the fact that they're doing that this late is really strange.
They're doing what this late?
They're sitting down with a blank sheet of paper and saying, who is our guy? And there's a quote in Politico story where they say, Trump doesn't have a foreign policy. There's no message there. And when your own people are saying that, and that it leaks, because another thing that typifies this 100 days worse than any other presidency is leaking. We thought the first 100 days of Clinton had a lot of leaking, and the first 100 days of Bush was really low in terms of leaking. They really had a great deal of message discipline and loyalty to George W. Bush. But Trump's team, I have never, ever seen a presidency that leaks like this. We know who said what to who a day, 2 days, 3 days, over and over and over again. And that really hurts the president. It is really hard to succeed with a White House with walls made of glass. If everyone sees the inner workings of your White House, you're very likely to fail as a president.
If a president does not achieve his main goals in the first 100 days when he is in that so-called honeymoon period, how likely or how difficult or easy might it be through the rest of his term to get anything accomplished?
There are presidents who did not land well and still ended up being very good presidents. The great example here is Truman. Whether we start counting the calendar from his first 100 days in office after FDR died or the first 100 days after he was elected and sworn in again in 48, he did not do very well in public opinion or in getting things through Congress. But the achievements that he made after that period, the Marshall Plan, aid to Greece and Turkey, the work he did to make NATO firm, these are extraordinary accomplishments. That is why, even though he did not have a good honeymoon, that he ranks very highly among our greatest presidents. So in other words, a successful honeymoon is a good sign that we'll have a successful presidency, but it is neither necessary nor sufficient. You can become a great president without a great first 100 days, and you can be a bad president who everybody loved in the first 100 days.
Right.
But it is a benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just that Trump's not doing well, it's the way he's not doing well.
That is Jeremy Mayer, a professor in the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs, George Mason University. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday. On the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan eked out a narrow referendum victory, even though the country's industrial heartland and the main cities voted against him for the first time in his political career. A loss of support coincides with an economic slowdown, which likely will be a major concern with presidential and general elections just 2 years away. Dorian Jones is in Istanbul with our report.
President Erdogan's referendum victory was bittersweet. For the first time, he lost in Turkey's main cities, including Istanbul, which has been his electoral power base since 1994. In the aftermath of his narrow win, he has ordered a party investigation into the vote. İnan Demir, an economist for Nomura Bank, points out that Erdogan's unprecedented electoral successes were achieved in a period of economic boom, but those halcyon days appear to be waning.
Currently, inflation rate is at 11.3%, and it is expected to increase further to around 12% in the coming months. It would constitute highest inflation rate since before the global financial crisis in 2009. And also, unemployment rate is also at multi-year highs. So we're talking about a significant acceleration in inflation and unemployment rate.
The impact of the economic slowdown has been felt most in Western Turkey, where more than 70% of its economic production is located, and most closely linked to European markets. While the Turkish economy is predicted to grow faster than that of Europe, it's still below the rate needed to absorb new entrants into the labour market. A striking development of the referendum was the youth vote overwhelmingly voting no, bucking its traditionally stalwart support for Erdogan. Atilla Yeşilada, a political consultant with Global Source Partners, says that should deeply concern the president.
Youth unemployment is affecting the first-time vote. Youth unemployment ratio was 25% in the last data. 58% of first-time voters voted no. According to OECD research, Turkish students are the unhappiest in the world, with 72% of them saying that they're very unhappy with the current conditions. So given Turkey's very high rate of young population, up to 6% of the voters in the next election cycle, which starts in March 2019, would be first-time voters, which in my view is slipping from their grasp.
2019 is scheduled for an unprecedented three polls of local, general and presidential elections. In the run-up to the referendum, the government launched major programs of cheap loans for businesses, job creation schemes, and the ramping up of massive public works projects. Economist Demir claims that with both individuals and private companies racked with debt, more state intervention is likely.
Turkey will find it difficult to sustain that debt-fueled growth. That's why I think the public sector will play a growing role in supporting economic activity going forward. Personally, I expect elections to be held earlier than the current schedule. I wouldn't be surprised if we see elections by this time next year. So I think it can be sustained until that time.
The pressure to call early elections will deepen worries about how the government will fund its growing economic and financial programs. Given that the bedrock of Erdogan's electoral success has been built on economic prosperity, the continuation and trajectory of those programs ultimately could determine his fate. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
In a week of trade discord, President Trump has vowed to take action to boost the American aluminum industry, which he says has been unfairly damaged by imports.
The American aluminum industry has been severely damaged by unfair foreign trade. Cheap subsidized foreign imports have flooded into the market, destroying thousands of great American jobs, jobs that are no longer.
Mr. Trump also said the aluminum industry is critical to the defense industry. Meantime, on the U.S. stock market, the Nasdaq Composite ended at a record high on Thursday, while the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones were little changed. Jacob Rappaport, head of equity capital markets at FC Stone Financial, says the markets are vulnerable to what's happening on the political scene.
Right now, it is very political in that we're weighing what's going to happen with the Trump tax plan, pending perhaps government shutdown, and later on, of course, into the German elections into the fall, along with the underlying tensions between Syria, North Korea, and, of course, Russia.
And on the trade scene, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says he has urged President Trump not to withdraw from the North American Free Trade Agreement because it could cause a lot of pain on both sides of the border. White House said earlier that President Trump told the leaders of Canada and Mexico in separate phone calls this week he would not terminate the NAFTA treaty at this stage, but would become quickly involved in renegotiating it with them.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
And now it's time to find out what's trending on social media with International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky.
Trending today, a new poll from the Associated Press that dispels some common stereotypes about teenagers and social media, and a new effort from Facebook to combat fake news. First, that poll from the AP of 13 to 17-year-olds. It finds that most of those surveyed had a positive association with social media as opposed to negative, which would seem to contrast with reports of cyberbullying and other negative activities that permeate social media. But even more surprising, perhaps, is that nearly two-thirds of the teens surveyed said they've taken a break from social media in the past year, the majority of which have taken a break for at least a week. Now, that being said, half of those who took a break said it was for one of two reasons. First, because their parents restricted their access to social media, either because they had their phone or computer privileges taken away. And second, because their phone was just broken. You have a broken phone, obviously you can't use social media. But even those who took a break voluntarily said that it had a positive impact on their lives, although the vast majority said getting back on social media after the self-imposed break period was important to them, and indeed many of those who took a break did go back on social media. Now to Facebook and their efforts to combat misinformation online. We talked about on the show earlier this week Wikipedia and Google's effort to combat misinformation, and now Facebook is following suit with a report titled Information, Operations, and Facebook. In that report, the company says that Facebook is expanding the security focus from traditional abusive behavior, things like bullying and account hacking, to include more subtle and insidious forms of misuse, including attempts to manipulate civil discourse and deceive people. And going forward, Facebook will be cracking down on what they call false amplifiers. These are fake groups or accounts trying to promote biased topics as legitimate news, in many cases using bots to do so. Facebook will also be expanding efforts to prevent hacking, including a two-step account verification system and increased notifications for users if their accounts are compromised. Now, their goals boil down to a quote from Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, which is included in the report. Zuckerberg writes that it's Facebook's responsibility to amplify the good and mitigate the bad to create the greatest positive impact on the world.
And many thanks to you, Andrew. International Edition's Andrew Palchevsky. By the way, you can follow Andrew on Twitter at APAL. I'm on Twitter as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers using two of NASA's X-ray space telescopes, as well as the Australia Telescope Compact Array, say they have found evidence of the tightest orbit of a companion star around the black hole. The star, a white dwarf, is said to circle the black hole at a rate of 2 times an hour from a distance equal to 2.5 times the separation between Earth and the Moon. The black hole white dwarf system was identified as X9, located in a Milky Way globular star cluster nearly 15,000 light years from Earth. The scientists say the white dwarf is so close to the cosmic abyss that stellar material is being stripped away and dumped into a disk of matter surrounding the black hole before it's pulled in by the tremendous gravity. While they don't think the white dwarf is in any danger of falling in or being torn apart by the black hole, the researchers say its fate is uncertain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, an extremely rare copy of the U.S. Declaration of Independence has been found in a vault in a southern English town. VOA's David Byrd tells us the document is thought to date from the 1780s and is one of only two ceremonial parchment copies of the Declaration.
The handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence has been stored for more than 60 years in a strong room among cartons of other documents. However, two Harvard University researchers, Danielle Allen and Emily Sneff, recently told British archivists in the West Sussex Records Office of the document's significance. Wendy Walker is the West Sussex archivist.
I mean, we knew we had it, we knew what it was, but we didn't have the knowledge that they have brought to it in terms of the connection with the original, I think. And so to have two Harvard academics turn up on your doorstep and start asking all these fascinating questions about one of your documents, you know, was really exciting.
The 60 by 76 centimeter document contains the text of the Declaration and the names of the signers, including John Hancock, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. Unlike the original, however, the names are not grouped by states. The so-called Sussex Declaration is thought to date to the 1780s, and researchers believe that it was originally owned by the 3rd Duke of Richmond, who supported American colonists during the Revolutionary War. Wendy Walker says the document raises a lot of questions and doesn't provide the answers.
How did it get to Sussex? How did it end up here? But behind all of those questions are the questions of when was it made, where was it made, why was it made, and who was it made for, and then how did it get here?
While other printed copies of the Declaration exist, the only other ceremonial parchment copy is the Matlack Declaration, which dates from 1776 and is kept behind glass at the National Archives in Washington. The Sussex Declaration will be sent to the British Library for studies on the ink and the parchment. West Sussex County archivist Wendy Walker says that advanced technology will help provide some of the answers to nagging questions about the document's date and provenance.
They will do hyperspectral imaging, which is looking at the document to see things that the naked eye can't see. So there'll be a whole series of tests and forensic examination being done on it over the summer, hopefully to give us a few more answers.
The Sussex office houses hundreds of documents that date back as far as 1,200 years ago. The Sussex Declaration will stay there, under lock and key, until it is transferred to the British Library. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
For more than 30 years, FilmFest DC has been bringing thought-provoking movies from all over the world to a discerning audience here in the U.S. Capitol, promoting discussion as well as debate. This spring, the festival is celebrating its 31st anniversary with 80 selected films. We get more now from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
Washington, D.C., where politics and culture intertwine. So it is no surprise to find films with social and political messages from all over the world in the city's film festival. Tony Giddens, founder and head of the Washington, D.C. International Film Festival, came to VOA to talk about this year's offerings.
These are films that look at the issues that have been heightened with the new presidential administration. So, for example, we're looking at immigration. We're looking at the importance of public education versus charter school or commercializing education. We're looking at the need for free press.
Among the films Giddens has selected is All Governments Lie, from Canadian filmmaker Fred Peabody. It traces the history of free, independent journalism and its significance to the pursuit of truth and preservation of democracy.
There's only two types of reporters. There's those who care and those who don't. Most of them don't care.
Another noteworthy film is the documentary The Good Postman, by Bulgarian filmmaker Tonislav Hristov.
Talibani, не знам какво ти е потребно.
Има хора, трябва да се дава шанс.
It looks at people who live in a small town and have to decide. I mean, Syrians are coming into their community. How do they adjust to it? Is it going to help their economy or is it going to hurt them in some way? And so these are issues that are faced by Europeans and Americans from day to day.
The festival offers a variety of films looking at social and cultural displacement from the perspective of ethnic communities existing as insular islands in other cultures. One example is A Wedding, a feature drama by Stefan Strecker. This French-Pakistani production deals with the values of a Pakistani family living in France and ends in tragedy when one of the daughters chooses a new way of life over tradition.
Bah oui, je résiste.
One of the most visually impressive films this year is Human. Photographer and filmmaker Jan Arthus Bertrand delivers breathtaking cinematography about humanity, weaving a picture of vast landscapes, the world as seen from up high, with mankind dwarfed in it. The filmmaker interviews people from all walks of life.
It's about the world, the whole planet, the environment, and as well as people's social needs, their economic needs and interests, how in a way we're different, but in fundamental ways we're very similar.
Gittens says it is not always easy to select films for intellectually demanding and politically savvy Washingtonians, but he says his year-long quest for the best selections are always appreciated. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Keep the Chains, a romance about a couple who meet at a community for autistic people, and Bobby Jean, a documentary about an American dancer and an Israeli dance company, were the top winners at the 16th Tribeca Film Festival in New York City. The Tribeca co-founder Jane Rosenthal happily noted that all the feature films this year went to people who, movies that is, directed by women entirely, and she tells us that the best international feature went to the Greek drama Son of Sophia. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America and at International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Top World News is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tuberculosis, or TB, is an ancient disease as old as humankind and the leading cause of death from an infectious disease globally. TB is a health problem nearly everywhere, particularly in developing countries, but nowhere more so than in Cambodia. This country of nearly 16 million people has one of the highest rates of tuberculosis in the world, with 380 of every 100,000 Cambodians estimated to be infected. About two-thirds of all Cambodians carry the TB bacterium, and every year around 13,000 people there die from the disease. The United States government, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been working with the National Center for Tuberculosis and Leprosy Control, or CNAT, a part of Cambodia's Ministry of Health, to reduce the morbidity and mortality of the disease. In Cambodia, despite great achievements, we still see one of the highest burdens of TB within the region, said Tina Lau of USAID's Cambodia office at the opening of the recently held National Tuberculosis Conference. We have narrowed the gap on missing TB cases significantly since 2000, but these still represent over one-third of total cases. USAID, in partnership with CNAT, has been developing innovative ways to identify the missing cases, such as targeted screening of the elderly at pagodas, improving diagnosis of TB among children, and strengthening linkages between hospital departments so that when patients with TB symptoms are seen at other departments, they are referred for TB testing. USAID participates in the Global Stop TB Partnership and partners with national TB programs, civil society, and the private sector to support worldwide TB control efforts, including here in Cambodia, said Tina Lau. We are proud to be a part of the effort in Cambodia, given the remarkable achievements of the national TB program.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.